Hi, everybody. We have a Patreon that we call Maltreon. You can join us. We have $3, $5, $10, $20 options. You can get newsletters from my dad, all kinds of neat stuff behind the scenes. Hang out with us, learn about who our guests are before anybody else, and listen to the podcast before anybody else. Go to patreon.com/maltononmovies for more information.
That's patreon.com/maltononmovies.
Hi, everybody. I'm Leonard Maltin.
And I'm Jesse Maltin.
You're listening to Maltin on Movies. And we welcome you and we welcome our special guest today, Tony Anselmo, who, well, there's nothing more to say about Tony except that he's a great guy, he's an old friend, and he's Donald Duck.
How about that?
Boy, it's so nice to be here with you guys.
It's lovely to see
you. I love you guys. I love your family.
We love you. I have to tell you, I looked online just for the hell of it. I wanted to see, and I went on YouTube, and there's a video of you interviewing Tony in the 80s.
That's the best interview we ever did.
Well, it's just so funny to think that's how long you guys have been doing this.
Longer than that.
Well, yes, but I mean, together that you've been, you've been on about a million stages together at this point, but... It's
Disney events and things.
Yeah, I love it. And you are a true legend. You know that.
Well, I don't consider, not to the caliber of Frank and Ollie, and you know, but maybe in contemporary times.
I think that the list of people who know Disney to its core, you know, the list of people who experienced it in a certain way with certain people as things were. As technology was changing, as the characters were changing, you keep something alive is so important.
Because we should explain that not only is Tony a voice artist with Disney for many years now and an assistant animator and
I love watching
other credentials that we could list. You're also a Disney buff, a Disney aficionado, and a Disney collector. So you're one of us.
Yes, I am one of us.
One of us. Yes.
One of us.
We accept him.
We have Ward Kimball drew from my dad. It's up there.
Oh, nice.
You know, I'm sure you have the same. It's getting to be around those kinds of people.
Oh, yeah.
There's nothing. It's priceless. It's lucky beyond. I'm so lucky that so many were still around when I was a kid. You know, I didn't understand who they were. I was too young. But the fact that I spent time with them, like Frank and Ollie, I'm so lucky because, you know, this next generation doesn't get.
I was thinking about that the other day because I missed them so much. And I never took it for granted. I always knew that I was blessed and lucky to be in their mentorship. And to be at the studio in the old animation building where all those things were made with those guys. I mean, when I started, they were pretty much all still there. And now they're all gone, and not only do I miss them, but I think that that tribal knowledge that they passed down to us, which was so precious to me, that I would like to pass down, but, you know, it's like a different world. That mentored the apprenticeship doesn't really happen anymore.
I think it can, but I think it's just different. It's like now when someone says to my dad, how do I become a film critic? And part of his answer is the same, which is read absolutely everything you can, watch absolutely everything you can. But it's what do you count as a critic? Does getting paid make you legit? Does being printed, well, print doesn't exist so much anymore. Does that, because that to me used to be.
It used to be you had to build a clipping file.
Yeah.
A clipping file. What a quaint idea.
Yeah.
What a great idea, though.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that's, I think it's just different.
Well, everything old is new again. Things do sometimes come back in the cycles of life. Not the circle, but the cycles of life. And who knows what's around the corner.
Yeah. Well, to that point, Leonard, did you see Once Upon a Studio?
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
We all got brought out of, the woodwork. I got to animate again on that and do the voice for Donald, and I did some of the cleanup on Goofy at the end. But that was, I think they did a great job on that short. I just think it's more Disney than a lot of things in a long time. And to see all the characters together again, and that Bernie was in it.
Yeah.
And
let's stop and explain a few things. First off, cleanup. Explain cleanup.
Well, the process changed around, I don't remember, the late 80s, I think. I started as an animator training with Eric Larson. And I animated on Mickey's Christmas Carol and Little Mermaid and Great Mouse Detective up into... I was a directing animator on the wardrobe on the Beauty and the Beast. Mm-hmm. And then they... it used to be a unit system where Frank and Ollie would have their unit. They would be in charge of, like, flora and fauna on Sleeping Beauty. Mm-hmm. And they would have assistant animators and breakdown and in-betweeners. And they would do both the roughs and the cleanups. And around the mid-80s, they split the department so that the directing animators would have an assistant and they would do the rough stuff.
Yeah.
And then they'd pass it over to the cleanup department, who would clean it up for the final drawings that were in the film. That it didn't used to be that way.
Yeah.
So I was much more detail-oriented, and I felt like I was better. So I was a directing cleanup on Porter and Tarzan, and that's when I switched over. And then we would go back and forth between the films and help
out. One of the things I didn't understand, it took me a long time to really, truly understand, is that animators are not necessarily cartoonists.
Mm.
There's a big difference.
They're really actors.
And when I would, as a younger person, ask them to draw me something, like as a souvenir, sometimes the results weren't that great because they couldn't do a perfect drawing of Mickey or a perfect drawing of whatever character you name. That's not what they did. Animate is about movement. Animation, I mean, it's Latin root and all that,
right,
is about movement.
Timing,
that's what
weight.
They did. They knew how to move the features on a face or the body language of a character. And that was the key to a great animator. And that great animator was trailed by people who improved his actual drawing. It's all he, so I'm saying
clean
his.
Up. That's...
Yeah, clean up the drawings.
Well, that's the way it became in the 90s. But you can look at Frank and Ollie's roughs, quote unquote, mm-hmm. and they're spot on model. Mm. There is no room for, you know, choice on where to put the cleanup line. Mm-hmm. It's right there. And to your point, they probably could draw Mickey Mouse if they'd had a little practice
right.
and a model sheet, but they never did. They were probably on another character. So when you say, can you draw Alice? You could say, well, give me a model
sheet. I can try.
It's really more about that. But later on, a lot of the directing animators became very rough, very rough.
Yeah.
And then, as you say, the cleanup leads were the ones that tightened it up and kept it looking consistent throughout the film between different animators.
Well, see, that's part of animation to me in general still blows my mind. It's one of those, like, I understand and I don't understand at the same time, because the amount of effort, even the first time you see one of those cameras, right? And they're 20 feet tall. Not little, I mean, that's what they feel like
to
me.
The multiplane.
They're huge. And you're looking at them and you're going, who? How? And each little movement, each piece has to go in, and somehow it all looks good.
Craftsmanship.
And that's it. And then there's little things, like I said this to Eric Goldberg once, because I said, can someone please explain to me how they make things sparkle? How do they make Ariel's wedding dress sparkle? How do they make the ocean sparkle? Because again, I understand that you do a dot and it moves, and you do a dot and it moves. But that's not what it looks like in the movie. It looks like it's sparkling. And it just blows my mind to this day. And no disrespect to computer animation, because the things they're able to do are incredible. But there's nothing to me quite like...
When you look at Fantasia and the detail and the you know, color and the effects, everything you're talking about, that was all painted.
Yeah,
yeah, it's staggering.
Drawn.
It's staggering.
You know, they may have had tricks like double exposure, but that was about it. They had to do it with their bare hands.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'm much more impressed with craftsmanship than technology.
Well, did you go to when they showed Bambi some years ago now at the Academy? They did a big thing, and Andres Deja showed the it was not finished animation.
Pencil tests.
Yeah.
Pencil tests.
Yeah. Do you remember if you were there that night?
Probably.
So I hadn't seen Bambi on a big screen since I was little and was frankly kind of terrified because I'm super sensitive and Bambi, I can't. I was sitting between my parents, which helped. I was like 20. It's not like it was yesterday, but I get very emotional watching that movie. And seeing it on that big screen at the Academy, my God, it's beautiful. Like, if somebody told you it was made yesterday, you'd believe it because it has not aged. It looks
timeless.
Incredible.
It stands the test of time and it's impeccable. And you lose track of the fact that you're looking at drawings and paint.
Yeah.
You believe Bambi
exactly.
is a real deer. And that, you know, Walt said the minute you're aware that you're watching paint and pencils,
it's all
you've
done, yeah.
you've ruined the illusion of life.
Yeah.
And Bambi, they say, was his favorite. I think it's spectacular.
I
love Dumbo.
It's so, well, see, God, I'm too sappy and I'm too emotional and I watch those and my heart just breaks too much. But beautiful. My God, they just say they blew me away. And the best thing about that night, seeing that pencil test, it was Bambi and Thumper on the ice.
Mm-hmm.
It was them learning to ice skate. And what we all said walking away from it was, just in pencil, it was all there.
Mm-hmm.
Just
and that
in
was
pencil,
Frank.
It was all there. And just like you say, you know, you mentioned like weight and things like that. It looked, you could have published that and people would have gotten it.
That's why, you know? When animation art became a popular collectible in the 70s and 80s, the animators didn't keep any cells because that wasn't their work.
Right.
Yeah.
Their work was all in pencil. Mm. Then it was traced by inkers and painted by painters, the ink and paint department, which was mostly female at the Disney studio, at most studios. And so it's their work somewhat diluted. It's their way of thinking. And what they saved, if they saved anything, was drawings.
Their rough drawings. Yeah, they didn't keep the rough drawings. The cleanup drawings are all still in the, well, I could still call it the morgue.
The morgue, yeah.
They call it the
Animation Research Library.
But the cells are what you saw on the screen. But when you look at the pencil tests, it's magic.
Yeah.
And you had to study. One of the things that, when I started at CalArts, Jack Hanna said, it takes 10 years to be a Disney animator. And I thought, oh, it can't. I mean, I'm already kind of doing it now.
Mm.
But he was right. And Frank and Ollie said that later, and so did Eric. It's like being an opera star or a great pianist or a ballerina. It takes 10,000 hours of study to be a Disney animator and to understand how anatomy works, how to do it for real, how the weight, physics, all that stuff, and then to caricature it, and to be entertaining, and to be an actor, to make someone feel emotion from your drawing, that's not easy to do.
No. Well, I go back to Andreas just first because I forget when, again, all this stuff, it's all jumbled in time, but there's a video I saw of him when I was quite young, when it was a whole video about how animators animate, and they were showing you everybody looking in mirrors and making faces and drawing them. And there's one where Andreas lifts his eyebrow and he's drawing a scar for Lion King. And all of a sudden I realized that the characters he's best known for, especially Jafar and Scar and those, they look exactly like Andreas. Their facial expressions look like Andreas. And because he was one of the first that I knew in person, when we would sit with him, I'd watch him and I'd go, oh my God, it's you, it's your face. I'm watching your face, and that's what I'm seeing in the movie, because that is what they're doing. They're bringing it to life. And it's still, I laugh because when I see him, it's what I think. You know, I go, gosh, I picture you. I picture you in these characters. That's how drawing by hand affects it. You know, it really is coming from you. Again, no disrespect to the technology, because there is so much that can be done.
But there's but it's a sameness the same. About it.
Yeah. Where did you grow up? Let's go there. Where did you grow up?
I grew up.
Yeah, let's rewind.
Yes.
Go back to the beginning. I was born in all places, Salt Lake City, because my grandfather came from Italy to work in the copper mine. Okay. And we moved, my immediate family moved to Northern California when I was 7, 1967. And I grew up high school and all that in Northern California, in Silicon Valley, in Sunnyvale, yeah, yeah. where the Google plant is now. Yeah. There used to be orchards. And then I came down to Disney when I was 16 to show them my portfolio. Which was, I think about that now, still when I'm in that building. So long, you know, it was a long time ago.
Yeah.
Now. My dad did not want me to work for Disney. He wanted me to be a banker, an accountant.
Sure.
And I was like, that's not going to happen. I got to get out of here. So I had been writing Frank and Ollie and Eric and Jack. You know, what do I need to do? They said take night courses in figure drawing, acting, color design. I got a portfolio together, and I asked my parents if I could go with some family friends who were going to Disneyland, which was true.
Mm-hmm.
But I left out the part where I had made an appointment to stop at the studio and show Don Duckwall and Jack Hanna and Frank and Ollie, a couple other people, my portfolio. I'll never forget that day. It was so overwhelming to be in that building. And Walt hadn't been gone that long at that
right,
point.
Right.
You could still feel it.
Mm.
They looked at my portfolio and they said, this is really good. We want you to work here, but we want you to go to CalArts first. And I said, I'd love to go to CalArts.
Yeah.
But my dad refuses. He will not let me. And I can't afford it. And they said, well, step out in the lobby for a minute. And I did. And about 15 minutes later, Ron Miller went in the room.
Yeah,
I thought, what's he doing?
Ron Miller being
Walt's
son-in-law,
yeah,
who took over the studio. He was running the studio.
He was
married
the CEO
to Diane,
Wonderful Diane. I miss her too.
Yes, oy, yes.
So he came back out of the room and he looked at me and he went thumbs up, and I thought, and they said, come on back in. So the Disney family is going to pay for you to go to CalArts.
Oh my gosh,
and I'm still.
I want to cry when you say that.
But that is why I have this loyalty.
Yes.
And this passion.
Yes.
I wouldn't be here if it weren't for them.
Yeah.
I wanted to be a part of what Walt did.
Yeah.
And that his family allowed that to happen.
Yeah.
That's why I'm a little ferocious when it comes to protecting that legacy, because, you know, new people come in and they come from other studios and they've never seen a Donald Duck cartoon. And they'll write a soliloquy and wonder why you can't understand it. And, you know, then I have to be the bad guy. And
but this, see, this is very, it's funny you say that, because that is, I think that's very much how we are, obviously not having had that experience, but because we've known so many, whether it was Diane, Walt's daughter, who was an incredible woman.
Yeah.
You don't talk about fierce.
Strong.
She was an incredible woman, you know, and knowing Ron and, you know, and the siblings and everybody. And then I went to school with the other side. I went to school with Roy's side.
Roy Patrick?
Yeah. So Roy the Fourth is, we call him My Roy, because that's who I was. He was in my class. We grew up together. And his two sisters, one was a year younger, the other one was a few years younger, grew up with all of them. So for me, whenever people want to say something about Walt Disney or the like stuff like that, forget Disney as a company, because yeah. My God. But when you want to talk about that stuff, I will fight you tooth and nail.
Good. Because
no.
But I have that same feeling, and I never... I grew up 3,000 miles away in New Jersey, but I felt such a bond with Walt Disney from watching him on television every
growing
week,
up,
year after year after year. I felt it very, very strongly. Mm. And it's only augmented and enhanced by all the people that
we've gotten to know.
That must have been wonderful for you to go to the studio and watch all those. Didn't you go in the screening rooms? I know you brought some of them home, the films for your book, the Disney films.
No, you know where they watch them. In my grandparents' basement.
But didn't you? You went to the lot.
No.
Oh, well, no.
I did. No, I had. When Walt died, I was publishing my fanzine, Film Fan Monthly,
right.
And I've told this story so many times. I decided to devote an entire issue to Walt's filmography, from Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs to The Jungle Book, and including the live-action films too. And I made a cold call to Walt Disney Productions, as it was then called, in the Manhattan phone directory, and was connected by fate to Arlene Ludwig.
Oh, wow.
Who is still our family.
Who is still a friend.
Still our family. Too.
And her dad.
And her dad, of course, had been
Irving Ludwig.
Walton Roy's,
attorney.
Choice. No, he ran Buena Vista.
Oh.
He was their choice to run the book, their brand
right,
new
because Arlene was a publicist.
Distribution company. Mm-hmm. Anyway, to get back on track, I just felt a connection, and that led to my writing that book, the Disney films.
But where you watched those films,
and they gave me permission to go to the local
basement.
The local distributorship
for
16mm prints. That you could rent.
Which conveniently.
And they had a VIP section that were only available for, for VIPs. Technicolor prints, too, of all these films. Almost all. They didn't have Fantasia. They didn't have Snow White. But they had almost all of them. And I screened them all in my basement.
It was in New Jersey. This spot was in New Jersey, not far from where he was. So it was serendipity in that way. And he would go... Each they'd give him one, he'd go home, he'd screen them. What do you like to say? You had a lot of people in the house for the earlys, and by the time you got to like the forest and nature, he was all
in
alone.
Search of the castaways.
Yeah, he was all by himself.
Yes, was all alone by then.
Yeah,
because I watched every one of those films chronologically, and
all the shorts too.
No, not all the shorts. As many as I could get my hands on.
Yeah.
And
on a white sheet in my grandparents' basement
yep.
in Teaneck, New Jersey.
Do you know that I, when I started at the studio, I did the same thing because in those days you didn't have DVDs or the internet to watch them. And Disney had their 16mm vaults, and we were allowed to check out one a month. And I would bring home the projector and the screen, and I'd start with Snow White and go all the way to The Happiest Millionaire. I watched them all because I wanted to... See the ones that I hadn't seen, and we could get the shorts from the cutting department on 35mm and watch them on a moviola. You push your foot on the. And lately, I've started collecting IB Technicolor 16mm prints of Disney films because I don't think most people know this, but when they put them on the Disney Channel or DVDs and they restore them. They really beef up the color.
Yeah.
And I was noticing, I thought, I don't remember it being that fluorescent.
Mm.
And I bought an IB Technicolor print of Alice in Wonderland and watched it at home. And I'm like, oh, that's what I remember. So I've started to buy all my favorite. I have about 100 Donald Duck cartoons in IB Technicolor.
Oh, my.
That's
because
great.
That's the real color. That's exactly what they saw.
Yeah.
In their release.
I have some IB Tech prints too.
Yeah. I've heard that you do. We'll have to talk.
It's a terrible skill to have. I can smell vinegar. I'm
yeah.
really good at identifying vinegar syndrome.
Yep.
And as a kid, that was a job
that
I had, was to sit there. And the first time you had me do it, I was down there for about an hour. And I remember going, I don't feel so good. And he said, "Dude, why don't you come upstairs for a bit, get some air? Maybe that's not the best idea to do for such a long period." Sitting there sniffing film cans.
When
going,
you find one with vinegar syndrome, do you put it somewhere else?
Depends.
Yeah, the garbage bin.
Depends on how bad it is.
Right.
Because there's one that he kept in our freezer.
I've got one in my
freezer. For a very long time. A Charlie Chase short that he kept in our freezer that finally, now, after being in the freezer for 15 years or whatever it is.
20 years.
Has finally gone kaput. But hey, that freezer kept it going.
Yeah.
Kept it alive.
It started shrinking and warping finally. Yeah.
But let's
return to your story.
Okay.
That's something that's very them, especially them at the time, to say, we're going to send you to this place. We're going to support you.
Who was in your class when you were at Cal Arts?
I was in the class with Dave Pricksma, Tony DeRosa, Kathy Zielinski. I'm getting very old and my memory is not. Mark Henn.
Yeah.
And the class before, two classes before us was Tim Burton and John Musker and
everybody else.
Everybody else. Yeah. But we were like, we were the third class, I think.
Yeah.
And it got whittled down to about 14. So that was really like hands-on teaching because it was a small class.
Yeah.
And then 14 of us were sent to the studio then. For 8 months, we weren't on a production. We were getting more training. We were put in the rooms next to Eric Larson, and he would give us scenes to animate, and we would have more life drawing and more. He'd bring us into the sweat box, the same sweat box he would be watching Pencil Test with Walt Disney. Yeah. That's all I could think of,
course,
when I was in there.
They called it the sweat box. It was a small screening room. Because, if you haven't already guessed, the animators and the directors would have to show footage to Walt, and they would break into
and
a sweat.
And hope that it was good.
Yes. Break into a sweat with anxiety.
Yes. And Eric would run, like Ichabod and Mr. Toad, and he'd, stop it and say, now, watch this. Watch how both characters aren't moving at the same time. This one will slow down. And then, we do that one day, and then... So you know that picture from Sleeping Beauty in the hallway of Walt talking to Eric Larson?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Those two doors at the back of that picture were our training rooms. So we were in that same wing, and Eric was still in the room he was in when he was directing Sleeping Beauty. So for 8 months, we were being trained more before we were ever put on production. And then four of us were picked out. It was me, Kathy Zielinski...
So were you like 19 at the time? 19, 20?
20 by then.
Yeah.
I think I was 18.
Just a baby.
At Cal Arts. Because we were only there for 2 years and then another year in training at the studio. But we were given scenes from Mickey's Christmas Carol to animate with Eric. The Fezziwigs dance sequence. I did 3 or 4 of those scenes and the other people with Eric. He would pass the scene out to us like a director. I went in and he gave me the scene where it's on an ornament and Clarabelle and Horse Collar are dancing. And he goes, okay, this is what I want you to do. And he grabs my hands and he starts dancing with me. And I'm like, pay attention, Tony. He's just showing you about
weight.
But all I could think of was I'm dancing with Eric Larson.
Right.
Eric Larson was one of Walt's 9 old men. That was an appellation... given to them or thrust upon them, perhaps, that referred to FDR's packing the Supreme Court at the time with not the 9 justices. And Walt's 9 old men were the cream of the crop.
The heavy hitters.
Yeah.
The heavy hitters in the animation world. There were other great animators as well at the studio, but these 9 guys... got singled out, and they all became legends with a capital L.
Yeah.
And the one who became really the chosen teacher, the one gifted with the ability to pass on his knowledge and his know-how. Not just knowledge, but savvy about animating, was Eric Larson.
He was so patient and so kind. The other guys were tough. he had, you know, standards.
Of course,
but,
yeah.
He was very, because I struggled with trying to get something, and I'd do the best that I could, and I'd bring it into him, and he would be at the desk, and I'd be standing behind him, and he'd look at it, and he'd go, well, what if we tried this? And he'd put a piece of paper over, and he'd hardly touch the paper with his pencil, and I'd watch this come out of there, that pencil, and think, oh my God.
They make it look crazy.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Just spectacular. He was also from Salt Lake City, where I was born.
Yeah.
And I was going home for Christmas one year, and I said, you want me to bring you anything back? He said, yeah, bring me back some snow. So when I got to the airport to come back, I got a cooler and some dry ice, because in those days you could do that.
Right.
I put dry ice on the bottom of the cooler and filled the cooler with snow and taped it up and brought it home. And the next morning I said, here you go. He goes, what's that? I said, open it up. And he went, oh. He made a snowball and threw it at me in his office.
That's magic.
Now, okay, now, here comes the question.
How did you become a duck?
How did you become the voice of Donald Duck?
Well, the studio was very small. There were only 63 people in the animation department at that time. And all the other people in live action and publicity, and including Clarence Nash, they were always around. And everybody knew each other because there weren't a lot of people.
Yeah.
And so I got to know Clarence, who was a really sweet man. And I was always the class clown and did imitations of my teachers and all that. But Donald was not a voice that I could do. So just for fun, with no intention, I said, how do you do that? And he said, well, start with this. And he showed me, there's like three or four stages. And it's really like learning a language. It takes 4 years.
Sure.
It's like learning French. And I worked on that privately. And the next time I saw him, I said, is this it? And he looked at me and he said, "That yes, that's it." And I thought, and he kind of walked away. And I thought, oh, I hope I didn't offend him. Because he had a kind of a strange look in his eye. And then, like a week later, he came into my room and he sat in my airline chair and said, okay, if Donald was in this kind of situation, what would he say? Or if Mickey said this, what would Donald say? Try saying this. And I thought, he must be bored. Because why?
Yeah.
I didn't know, nobody knew that he had leukemia. Even a lot of his family, which I still stay in touch with. I was just talking to his daughter, Kay Nash, last night. She's 92. And, you know, if it weren't for him, I wouldn't be here. There were all these men that handed this legacy to me, which is why I'm like, you know, so protective and passionate about it. Anyway, so he would, I didn't know that he had, I think in hindsight, he was trying to make sure that not only could I do it, and it took a while, but that I would be respectful to it, not change anything.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until he was in St. Joseph's that he told me. And it was a very bittersweet moment because I did not see that coming.
No.
And if I had, I would have asked more questions. But fortunately, Jack Hanna lived another several years, so I could go to him and say, okay, I'm having trouble with this. And he goes, oh, yeah, this is what you do.
Jack Hanna became the primary director of the Donald Duck cartoon shorts.
Yeah.
In the 1940s.
I think he had as much to do with what Donald ended up to be than anybody, because he was also working on the earlier ones where he wasn't a director, as a storyboard artist with Carl Barks. And he tried very hard to become a director, and did. And I personally, some of them, like Toy Tinkers, and they're really well done.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a favorite? I know, I realize that's a big question. Do you have a favorite Donald cartoon, or is there, do you have a favorite cartoon in general from then? Is there something?
Well, my favorite cartoons are probably the more elaborate ones like The Ugly Duckling or The Old Mill, the classics that are just so lavish. And so, you know, when you look at The Ugly Duckling, there's no dialogue. That's a thing that's been lost. Telling a story with no dialogue.
Yeah.
And making your audience get emotional with no dialogue.
There is an episode, I love Bluey deeply, because of Daisy, I watch Disney every single, we listen to you every single day.
Sorry.
Many hours a day, I have you on.
Mickey Mouse Clubhouse.
Mickey Mouse Clubhouse.
On Disney Junior.
Which we love, 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 love. That's Daisy's favorite. But there's an episode of Bluey. I think it's called The Rain, where no one speaks. Except at the beginning, they say bye, and that's it. And I cried watching it the first time because it's just a really beautiful episode. But I immediately went up to my parents. I said, you have to see this. Because when does that happen? When do they trust that just watching is enough, that you can understand everything? And it is. It's funny, but it's also very sweet. And I do. I think about that.
You have to be good to tell a story with no dialogue.
Pixar has done it once or twice.
Yeah.
Show it, don't say it.
Yeah.
And I realized I just sounded like Norma Desmond when I said, and no dialogue.
My favorite's Clock Cleaners. I love Clock Cleaners a lot.
When they're in a group like Boat Builders and not Steamboat Willie, but the later one where they run a tugboat, Mickey. Is a good one too, and you'll notice something that a lot of the new writers don't, that he doesn't say much. You know, what's the big idea? Oh boy, hot dog is about it. And they will also take the music down when he's talking. As I've noticed in some of the things I've done lately, they'll have trumpets behind him, and you really, you know, it's the same frequency as his voice, and
it's a lot. Yeah.
The audience is going to be on the other end going, what did he say?
There's a famous New Yorker cartoon from the 30s. It's the interior of a gigantic movie theater. And you can see that on the screen is Donald Duck. And in the foreground of the cartoon, a man is turning around and saying to the person behind him, shh!
Is it ever surreal, though, to think that you're Donald Duck? Like, is that ever kind of...
I think I'm so protective of it, and I don't... Clarence would walk around with his puppet and always talk like Donald Duck.
Really?
Which is hard.
Yeah.
It's exhausting.
Oh, it's a... You have to be... It's a
strong
skill to figure out how to do that with your voice.
Calisthenics, yeah.
Yeah, you're putting your whole body into it.
Yeah.
So I don't really do that, and I like the anonymity and that I can go to the store and no one knows who I am, or I can go to Disneyland and nobody knows that Donald Duck is there.
Right.
But I like that. I wouldn't want to be an on-camera celebrity or two. I don't like attention.
Well, I always think that's sort of, it's how I feel about the voice of The Simpsons, folks like that who are, you know, the level of famous. If you think about a show like The Simpsons, right? People know it all over the world. I doubt they could visually pick out Homer Simpson or Bart Simpson. So it's exactly that to me. I feel like voice actors, it's like you're undercover one of the most famous people in the world.
Yeah.
You are undercover Donald Duck.
I like being undercover.
You know, but what an incredible thing that you get, you know, you're Donald Duck.
Well, like, I didn't do it for any kind of attention or money. It was always about the legacy.
Yeah.
It was always about preserving something that meant a lot to me, and that people in the Disney family and Jack Hanna and Clarence Nash and all those people were kind enough to pass that on. And that's what I care about.
Of course. It's just, they say for me, celebratory-wise, pretty damn cool.
Well, thank you.
You know what I mean? Pretty damn cool.
It's interesting, too, that Donald is a character who exists because of his voice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Walt chanced to be listening to the radio, supposedly while he was driving, and he was listening to a local Los Angeles radio station where Clarence Nash was performing and using that voice. And it made him laugh. And he said, we ought to hire that guy and create a character to match that voice. And so the voice, it all began with the voice.
Right.
And the Walt used to say it all started with the mouse. But in this case,
yeah.
it started with the voice.
And Clarence Nash.
And then he was also the first angry cartoon character.
They didn't have to be careful with Donald. And that's Jack said that's why he became so much more popular than Mickey in the 40s, because he could be a rascal.
Yeah.
And you couldn't get away with that with Mickey because he became too precious. But yeah. a lot of people don't know that Clarence did a lot of other, like anytime you hear a bird in a Disney movie, Bambi or Clear Up to the Tiki Room, that's all Clarence.
Mm. Wow.
And frogs and horses and I can't do any of that.
Yeah, it's a whole thing.
He had a menagerie.
I laugh thinking about the fact that Bill Farmer is not just Goofy, but also Pluto. I love the idea that, you know, one is so identifiable, the Goofy voice. The other is going, yeah, you know, and little barks and nip. It's that kind of stuff. I just laugh, you know. And we love Mel Blanc and people like that.
Jim Foray.
Could just do everything, anything.
And people who, and I was guilty of this when I was younger, people who do voices are not voice people. They're actors.
Oh, God, yeah.
They're actors. And sometimes they're singers as well. And
you have to be able to sing.
Sing, this is something having now watched all 100 and something episodes of Mickey Mouse Clubhouse, three times, I think about that a lot with the singing. There's quite a bit of singing that happens.
A lot of singing. And you and Daisy will both be happy to know that we're starting Mickey Mouse Clubhouse 2. I think we've recorded about eight episodes in, and there's a song in every show.
Oh,
so you do have to be able to sing, and you have to be able to be funny and improvise. You can't just imitate your predecessor. And June Foray, people would... You know, she was very active all over the industry.
Oh, yeah.
And people would come to her for advice. And she was straight up. I mean, that's what I loved about June, is she was like, she'd give it to you.
Yeah.
And she'd say, it's not about doing funny voices. You got to be an actor. You got to possess the character.
Yeah.
If you don't know the name June Foray, she's...
If you don't know the name, yes, you do.
Yeah. She was Granny in the Tweety and Sylvester cartoons. She was Natasha in the Bullwinkle and Rocky cartoon series. And Rocky, the flying squirrel. And innumerable
other there's no, I can't,
thousands
I
of
can't
voices.
Even guess.
For Disney, she was Lucifer the Cat.
Yeah.
And she was Witch Hazel in Trick or Treat, one of my favorite.
Mm-hmm.
She was, as a kid, I loved her because she was so tiny. We were like the same size. So as a little kid, she was the least intimidating person to me. So I always liked hanging around with her. And also, she is someone where her natural voice does sound a bit like the characters.
Yes, yes.
So that, as a kid, I always loved listening and going, oh, it's so you. And once you know her voice, you can identify it.
Like,
you know?
She lived into her 90s and was working
100.
To the very end.
Yeah. Very much so.
Couldn't stop her.
I remember I would go to the Academy screenings and we'd sit on this. Everybody always sat in the same seats and I'd sit behind her and we'd talk. And they showed the movie and afterwards they had a panel. And the panel people would be in the lobby waiting to go in after the credits.
Mm-hmm.
And people would go up and try to use the restroom before the panel started. So the movie ended. June got up and I went as well. We went to the restroom and the group was in the lobby and she just assumed they were. She looked at them and said, "Can you believe that pile of crap?" And
that was June. She was a legend. She was a teeny tiny legend.
Now, tell us some of the more unusual vehicles for your voice acting. If somebody buys a toy, a Donald Duck talking toy of some sort, that's your voice.
It is. Parades at the parks, or the cruise lines have shows. They have shows at the parks. Anytime video games are very big, I don't play them.
Yeah.
But there's, what was it, Kingdom Hearts?
Yeah, that was the whole thing. Yeah.
They're still doing those.
Yeah. When did Bill Farmer come in?
About a year after I did. Same with Rusi, because we had to do something where they needed all the characters, and at the time they didn't have them.
Yeah.
And Rusi was such a find. I mean, she... You
he was talking about Rusi Taylor, who was the voice of Minnie Mouse.
Right, and ended up marrying Wayne Allwine, who was the voice of Mickey Mouse.
Which is my favorite fun fact.
We all four, I say, were our characters, because I'm...
Yes.
Rusi was sweet and strong. And Wayne was kind of the leader, and we respected him. I was impatient, and but Wayne, I took for granted the gift that Wayne and Rusi had, because they made it look so easy, and it just came out of them because it was them.
Yeah, yeah.
They
yeah.
were acting, but they were being themselves.
Yeah.
And I often question, why is Mickey Mouse Clubhouse still the most popular show when we've done another 8 since then?
Mm.
And I don't generally watch them, but when we started Mickey Mouse Clubhouse 2, I went back and watched 1, which was 15, 20 years ago, and watched it. And I realized then that it was really because of Wayne and Rusi, because Wayne, in his voice, came out his soul that said, I love you. I'm your pal. You're safe here.
Mm.
And in every reading he gave, not only was it funny, I mean, we spent more time in those sessions because we did them together, laughing than getting the lines. It would take hours and hours. But they, I didn't give them enough credit. And the fact that he was my age, 63, still doing a falsetto that was warm and appealing. That I've lost my falsetto. I used to be able to do Adriana Castellotti in but I can't anymore. Lena Lamont.
No, it's this is the thing to me, and it really does blow my mind. So, as I say, Daisy turned 2 last week, and we have not forced anything upon her in terms of you must like this, you must like that. But she and I, for a while now, you know, we put Disney Junior on, and just because it's one of the shows that's there, and she seems to like it, and even when she was smaller... something that she liked. But in the last few months, she's really fallen in love with Mickey and Minnie. And I said to my dad, isn't it crazy that, as I say, without us, you know, I didn't buy her dolls, I didn't get her Minnie and Mickey stuff, but she just naturally loved those two. And now she does. She wants Minnie and Mickey stuff. She has Minnie and Mickey toys.
She noticed first.
That was a big one.
She noticed that I was wearing a Mickey Mouse watch. She came over to me and pointed to
And she goes, Mick Mouse. And both of us just went, oh my God, because that's the first time she'd done that. That was the first time that she'd started to recognize characters like in the wild. And then same thing, he has for juxtaposition, has a Bugs Bunny phone case. You know, you got the Mickey watch, the Bugs Bunny phone case. And she said her sort of version of Bugs Bunny and noticed that. Then realized that the water bottles I have for her have Minnie on them. And then just recently, when we watch Mickey Mouse Clubhouse, they do a roll call. And, you know, they say Donald, and they say Daisy. She goes, here! And it is my favorite thing. So, you know, it all just stands up. It's still, here's this little girl in 2023 watching it and loving it. And whatever I put on that has... the Fab Five plus Pluto in it, she watches and she loves. And the other day, she got to meet Mickey Mouse for the first time, and I didn't know how that would go.
This was a Halloween event.
A little Halloween event, and I
the
didn't...
The costume character.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know how she'd react. I wasn't sure if she'd be scared or not, because I think that they're bigger than kids think they'll be, you know, because they're adult size to some degree. They're still little, but... she sort of just stood there for a second. Goofy was there first, and she stared at Goofy, and she didn't know what to make of it. And then Mickey walked out. She looked at me, and Mickey started sort of making faces and, you know, joking around with her. And she was just like, what in the... Is that really Mickey Mouse? And I said, come over to me. And she didn't want to stand. She wanted me to pick her up. She felt better being picked up. But then she just stared at Mickey Mouse again. And I said, how many years ago was this mouse created? And here's this little girl who is just absolutely enamored. It's crazy.
Yeah.
You know? And we do now tell her that she's named after Daisy Duck, even though she isn't. Because why not? But it's just wild to me that it all still works. And that's when you said to me that you felt a part of it with Clubhouse was because of Wayne and Russi. But that's the thing, is it's just so special. And I say now as she looks around the house, she sees more and more of Grandpa's stuff, and she can recognize Donald Duck now. And she said Goofy the other day. You know, it still does what it does.
It's a tribute to Walt Disney that this many years since his passing, it's still,
yeah,
you know,
viable, more than viable.
Yeah. She loves them. You know, I have a Minnie Mouse stuffed animal that we keep in the car. And when we get in the car, she goes, Minnie! And you hand her Minnie Mouse. Like, say, I didn't... It's not like all she had... Her entire room was Minnie Mouse and every day was this, this, this. You have to love this. It just happened. Because you can't not. You know? You can't not fall in love with all of them. You just do. Naturally. You know?
Are there words that are particularly difficult... for Donald to speak, it's an
anti-disestablishmentarianism. Yeah.
See.
Anti-disestablishmentarianism. You can do it all
because of the hard consonants. It's a big word,
yeah.
But a small world like rules. So yeah. I can't. Donald can't say R's, L's, I-N-G's, end in any. There's a lot. That's why I say it's like learning a language, like learning French, you know, like I before E, except after C. There's so many of those that Clarence had to pass along. There's only certain things, less than five words. Now we can do more and they'll edit them together.
Right.
Which they couldn't do in the 40s. people will often say, you know, I think you're clearer than Clarence. And that's not true. I'm not. They just have editing tools now where they can take out the splat and cut. I can do five takes of a line and they'll take the first word from the first one and cut it together and it sounds great. But the editor gets as much credit for that as I do.
Watching the way you have to use your diaphragm when you go into
Donald. It's the whole body. So I have to go through the scripts and say there's a word like rear. You won't be able to understand that. So I'll find a word that means the same thing that doesn't have R, so I'll say last, which is very clear. You can't say rule. Rear.
Last.
It's nice and clear.
Yeah.
So I go through the script and do that kind of doctoring through the whole thing. It was nice, you know, in Clarence's day, he had Jack Hanna and the same writers and the same storyboard guys for 40 years, they'd all come up with it.
Yeah.
They didn't have to worry about that. But every project, we get new people.
Yes.
And it's hard. It's not their fault.
No, it do say it's a language, and it's becoming familiar with how something works. And understanding, as you're saying, that there are some words that just cannot be said, and you have to work around that, as you would if someone had an accent.
Very much the same. Good point,
Jesse. You can't pronounce it that way.
When someone has a very strong accent, you try for a little while to try and then you kind of give up.
Yeah.
It's the same with Donald. So I keep it short. I try and keep it clear. And, you know, to your point, words you can't say, there are a lot of them. But I just find the ones that he can and switch it.
Sure, sure.
he is a fully formed character.
Yeah.
And a fully formed person.
And the integrity of the character, his voice, the way he looks... That's why, you know, Ollie used to say, just because these are the most beloved characters in the last, at that time, 80 years, doesn't mean you can't destroy them. And a lot of times, people don't know, but, you know, if you have somebody, and you think of somebody that you love, a teacher, a grandmother, an aunt, your favorite person, if they suddenly came to Thanksgiving dinner and said, you know, dude, sup?
Sorry, what? Yeah. Well, there's those 2015 cartoons, I think around 2015, where they all look cracked out. Those are real weird.
Yeah.
Those are some real weird cartoons. No, that, and again, and I do imagine that is where you have to really go, this is, I mean, I watch them and I think, who the hell thought this was a good idea? But you say it's the characters, and having come up when you did with the people that you did, there is a love and a care about all of this. As I say, the way that I, so, you know, Walt Disney was gone long before I was born. And I have a loyalty to him that I find very important, in part because I know his family, and that means something to me. But also just in part because I feel that what he built was so important and beautiful, and look at how it still lives globally. And so to me, don't come for him, because I'll come for you.
Yeah, it's hard for me with, you know, the internet. There's so much misinformation and disinformation and all the lies about him.
Yeah.
Where I worked with the people that worked with him and heard it firsthand.
Yes.
No, he was probably more of a supporter of diversity than anyone at his time. Yeah. And
God bless Floyd Norman.
Yeah.
And really?
The Sherman Brothers.
Of course.
Everything. You know, none of that stuff you've heard and I keep hearing.
No.
And people say, was he real? No. He was not.
He had high standards.
And he people had high forget standards. That Joel, James Basquiat won a special Oscar for his work in Song of the South, and they had the premiere in Atlanta, and they didn't want him to go, and Walt said, he doesn't go, I don't go.
Mm-hmm.
So that tells you know.
It makes me crazy, all of that. But again, that's why we're so lucky that there are a handful of people. I love that we have Floyd. Floyd in general. We used to always say, he might be one of the coolest human beings on the planet. Like, he's just effortlessly cool.
Yes, he is.
But getting to have someone like him there, and the stories he can tell. Similarly, when you're sitting with Richard Sherman, who is an angel on earth, you know, these people, and you talk, who'd you say you came to my bat mitzvah with?
Jane Withers.
Jane Withers, you know, again, you want to talk about an angel. She's not Disney, but, you know, she was an angel. And that woman, you got to protect them with your whole life. Because they are so special and precious.
Then, and then there's you. Tony, you are a walking ambassador, walking, living ambassador for all things good associated with Disney.
Mm. Well, that's quite a compliment coming from you.
Well,
I think the same for you. I mean, you know you're Disney. You're a veteran who knows more about this subject than I think anyone. And to the point where there are misinformation on the internet about Walt Disney, there are also now historians that have manufactured a career with no education or experience. And there's a lot of that. And so, you know, to our listeners, this is a good podcast because these guys know what they're talking about, but there's a lot of misinformation out there.
I think that it's very easy to lie, but it's also very easy to sort of make things up. And nowadays, people don't
check it.
Research or anything like that.
They don't fact-check it.
You know, as I say, I forget Disney as a company, because that is business. And that is something I want no part of, the business. I love, and I feel we're so lucky to be around the people who built everything.
Yeah.
And are so special and have such incredible stories to share.
And the connections and the continuity are really remarkable. I mean, there's Leslie Iwerks, whose dad is still alive and well, and whose grandfather, Ub Iwerks, was a crucial part of Walt Disney's career.
Yeah. Leslie is carrying the torch in a phenomenal, I mean, really, the stuff that she's bringing out, and the people she's taught, because the people feel safe. You know, the Imagineers feel safe with her. They know that her goal is celebration, not to tear anything down.
Right.
And what Diane did with the Walt Disney Family Museum.
Yes.
I have so much respect for that, and she did such a great job. And Joanna, do you know that Joanna bought Uncle Robert's house in Hollywood?
No.
Oh, yeah, you'll love this. We got to get you over there because it's almost finished. Uncle Robert's house, this is the house where Walt and Roy, when they came from Kansas City, they stayed with their Uncle Robert on Kingswell, and they in the garage, they did their first animation. And down the street, they later bought the Disney Brothers Studio. That little building is still there. It's a copy center now. But anyway, Joanna bought, the house came up for sale. She bought it. She restored it impeccably with historical architects and contractors. It's almost finished. She rebuilt the garage, and she's going to use it for salons and lectures, and yeah. You would be great to go there and talk about all the things you know.
Yeah.
But the house is spectacular.
How exciting. Is that the one that Dusty Sage has been at? That must be a different one.
There's the Walking Way house where Walt lived in the late 30s until the 50s when
maybe
he moved
that's
to Carrollwood.
But they've just started doing events.
This was just... Yeah, that's that one.
That's that one? Okay. Yeah.
No,
okay.
This has been owned by other people all these years, and
wow.
She just, Joanna, Walt's granddaughter,
yeah.
Bought it and restored it, and she's going to use it for art classes and lectures. And
that's lovely.
That's perfect.
Yeah.
And you
were recording Donald
yeah.
again
yeah.
for a new
generation
and a new a new viewership that will grow up knowing
yeah.
and getting to love Mickey and Minnie and Donald and Daisy and Goofy and Pluto.
I hope so. That's the goal.
Yeah. Well, you're achieving your goal.
I just think every morning I wake up right now, I get Mick Mouse, because she wants us to put Mickey Mouse Clubhouse.
That's great.
Tony,
thank you for coming.
Thank you for having me. It's an honor.
Thank you guys, as always, for listening. We appreciate it so much. You can follow at Leonard Maltin, at Jesse Maltin on Instagram and Twitter. You're also on Facebook. We have a YouTube channel, Maltin on Movies. And there's leonardmaltin.com, which has movie reviews, book roundups, and all kinds of good stuff.
All of that is true.
And then there's the Maltreon Patreon, where you can help support what we do, which means the world. We like paying our engineer. It's a weird thing, but what can I say? We will see you next week. And everyone, be well.
Be well, be kind. See you next week.